Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, and podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. You can find us also at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later in the program, we're going to be speaking to a nurse practitioner about keeping healthy during the holidays. Right now, I would like to welcome Joe Illick. He is the executive and artistic director of the Santa Fe Concert Association. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here with you.
And we have the great pleasure of having you today and tomorrow talking about music. The Christmas Eve and New Year's Eve concerts at the Lenzic have become an annual tradition where people go in advance of their various other celebrations. And on those days, you choose music which is both some of the best music ever written and really crowd-pleasing for the whole family.
Yes, we do. I love the music that we pick because when you think of Christmas music, of course, there are Christmas carols, and we'll play some of those. However, at the concert, I feel like it's an opportunity to play some of the best music of all time and bring in a great soloist. We put together a wonderful orchestra, which is a combination of the New Mexico Symphony and the Santa Fe Symphony, and some players from out of state who love to spend their holidays here. And we really put on a terrific program for everybody.
So on Christmas Eve, there are two pieces, Samuel Barber's Cello Concerto and Beethoven's Seventh Symphony.
Yes.
Let's talk about Samuel Barber, an American, a 20th century American, born in Pennsylvania, a composer from the earliest age.
And a singer. Samuel Barber was a double major of voice and composition. In so much of his composition, even when there is no voice, you feel the influence of voice. You feel a lyricism that is unique to Samuel Barber. I think a lot of people lost track of the voice in American composition in the second half of the 20th century, especially. With Barber, it's always there. This cello concerto sings its way from a beautiful opening allegro through one of the most gorgeous adagios ever written to its exuberant finale. You can almost feel the soloists singing along with their instrument as they play.
The cello has a range which is not entirely unlike the human voice.
That's right. And so perhaps even more than the violin, which can play stratospherically high, higher than the human voice could ever sing, the cello imitates the voice, and at times you really feel that the cello becomes a voice.
Now, when Samuel Barber was composing this piece, he was really composing it for a particular player.
He was, and she must have been extraordinary. However, the soloist that is performing it Christmas Eve, I think, is even more extraordinary. The woman coming in is Wendy Warner. She has championed this piece all over the world. She's performed it all over the world and really has become intimately associated with this work. It's difficult to describe what a performer does that lifts their performance out of being merely excellent into something transcendent. But I've heard the recording of Wendy Warner performing this concerto with the Scottish National Orchestra under the baton of Maren Alsop, and it really is transcendent. She identifies with it so deeply, even though it's Samuel Barber's concerto, you feel like she's writing it and she's conceiving the work on the spot as she performs it.
It's so interesting to me how, okay, so Barber composes this with a particular, not only with a particular cellist in mind, but it was said that while he was composing it, he asked this cellist to play her entire repertoire for him. So he played it for her performing style. And so it's not some abstract thing where it's an abstract composition and then somebody plays it. It's very much of a personal thing. Wendy Warner comes along, and for her it's also a personal thing. Maybe she has the spirit of this original cellist, Raya, Garbosova?
I think it's more likely that she, and all of us who are performers, have our own spirit, and we connect with the spirit of the composer. And
Right.
It's really true that we all connect with something that has a more global reach than just the composer or the performer, because the musical language that a composer uses is connected to other musical languages. It doesn't crop up out of the blue, like, you know, you don't suddenly see a fish with wings and six eyes and gold and pink stripes on it. Everything in music has come from somewhere and it's going somewhere. So this lyrical musical language of Barber owes a lot to 19th century opera. It owes a lot to Beethoven. Any composer, if they were alive and could talk to you, would tell you what other music had shaped their own music. So when you perform a work, you bring to it all of your musical life, not just with the composer whose work you're performing, but all the other composers too. You know, it's funny because most pieces, whether they're instrumental or vocal, are conceived for specific soloists. And what's fascinating is how another soloist comes along, even in another era, in another century, and reinterprets a work in a way that is, of course, different from the way that original soloist performed it. And yet it remains true to the spirit of the original.
Right. So we're going to hear a little bit of the Samuel Barber Cello Concerto right now. And that was an excerpt from Samuel Barber's Cello Concerto. Now, Beethoven's Seventh Symphony, that is, I have to say, my favorite one. Not that I know them all so intimately, but it is an incredible piece of music. Tell us a little bit about the composing of this piece.
Beethoven felt more at home with a symphony orchestra than any other musical form that he had at his disposal. Of course, he wrote great piano sonatas and great string quartets and explored many different forms, but you feel, even in the other forms, that Beethoven is really thinking like he has a symphonic orchestra. If anything, by the time he writes the 32nd and final of his piano sonatas, he is striving to turn the piano into a symphony orchestra, which, of course, the piano can never truly become. The Seventh Symphony must be the most joyful and exuberant of all of Beethoven's symphonies.
And considering the Ninth, that's saying a lot.
Well, considering the Ninth, that is saying a lot. I think that the Ninth is a lot more about Beethoven's ideas, and the Seventh is a lot more about Beethoven's feelings. He has a side which is so exuberant and so full of energy and joy. That's why I thought this was a great piece for a Christmas Eve concert. The third movement of the four movements was the one that Wagner called the apotheosis of the dance. And I think that's incredible coming from Wagner. This whole symphony is a journey of feeling from exploration to discovery to triumph. And it has also a very famous second movement, which maybe we can play some of right now.
Let's hear some of the famous and beautiful second movement.
Thank you.
and that was a piece of Beethoven's Seventh Symphony, Second Movement. And this piece is so famous, and even on its premiere was so well loved, that didn't they make the orchestra play just the second movement as an encore?
Yes, they did. By this time, Beethoven couldn't hear anything. He was almost completely deaf.
And it's unbelievable that he could compose something like that and only hear it inside of his
head. Yes, it is.
So I also read that T.S. Eliot was asked to have the second movement played at his funeral. And I thought, Eliot, you stole my idea. I bet a lot of people have done that.
Well, if you'd like to have that played at your funeral, you just...
I would indeed. I'll let you know. Meanwhile, the third movement, one doesn't think of symphonies as associated with dance.
This particular movement is extraordinary because it's called a scherzo. And in symphonic repertoire, this word scherzo, which is Italian for joke, came to mean a very specific thing. Certainly humorous and lighthearted in Beethoven's hands, but not a joke. Other composers used that word scherzo to mean something quite different. Chopin wrote four scherzos for the piano, and they're not lighthearted at all. So Beethoven found an outlet not only for humor and good-natured music making, but also for truly creating dance in music with this one movement. Let's hear it.
And that was a piece of the third movement of Beethoven's Seventh Symphony. And the Beethoven and the Samuel Barber will be performed at the Lenzic Theater here in Santa Fe on Christmas Eve. I think there's still tickets available.
Yes, there are a few tickets still available.
Excellent.
By the way, that concert on Christmas Eve is at 5 p.m.
Right, and that's awfully nice of you to do it at 5 so that we can be out of there by, what, 7 o'clock?
And we'll be out of there by 6:30 and walking among the Farolitos by 7.
Right, and then going home and having dinner and doing presents or whatever people do on Christmas Eve. Now, New Year's Eve, you're doing the same thing. I think it's also at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. A concert also at the Lenzic, Rachmaninoff's Piano Concerto No. 2.
Right. This was a turning point in Rachmaninoff's life. He was a man who composed so easily. It came to him very naturally. He was a great pianist himself. He had a medical condition which meant that his hands and his feet and his ears were slightly larger than most people, so that in addition to being a great virtuoso, he had a tremendous reach at the piano. A lot of his works are characterized by a span or a stretch at the keyboard, which is larger than normal, and most of us can't reach it simply.
Making life more difficult for pianists to come.
It makes it a challenge for pianists, and all pianists love to tackle the great piano concertos by Rachmaninoff. This perhaps is the most famous with the most famous melodies, and was extraordinary as a turning point, as I say, because Rachmaninoff had reached a point in his career when he had composer's block. Couldn't write anything, and he couldn't somehow break through. So this piece was his therapy, his hypnotist. That was the kind of therapy he was doing. His hypnotist somehow unleashed in him the desire to create more melodies in a single piece than he had ever done before. So this piece is wall-to-wall melody. As soon as one great tune ends, another one starts.
Let's hear a little bit of the Rachmaninoff Piano Concerto No. 2. And that was an excerpt from Rachmaninoff Piano Concerto No. 2. Now, you are going to have a great pianist in to Santa Fe playing
yes.
the piece.
So excited that Andrew von Oyen is coming to Santa Fe. He has performed all over the world. His reviews for this concerto everywhere he performs it are that people knew it was a great concerto, and then they walk out and they feel like they've never heard it. They'd never heard it before. They heard this man play it. Not only for his technical ease, but his deep passion and his seeming effortlessness of being able to communicate this music as one huge span. Not lots of little bits, but he just conceives the whole thing as one piece, and it comes out that way.
Very interesting. When you have soloists, so Christmas Eve, Wendy Warner, and New Year's Eve, Andrew von Oyen, do you have time to have the orchestra work with the soloists?
Yes. We have a rehearsal the day before, because every soloist does things their own way. And our job as an orchestra, when we're performing with a soloist, is to be their accompanist and to support every musical idea that they have with the way that we perform along with them, so that it's never the same.
And so you have the conductor, obviously, who is mediating all of this, but the individual players in the orchestra really have to become listeners in a special way when there's a guest soloist.
Yes, it's like playing chamber music with 65 people. The wonderful thing is that often people think we rehearse so that we know exactly what we're going to do in performance. That's not really true. We rehearse so that we sort of know what we're going to do in performance, but we're prepared enough that we could do anything in performance. And it's very common that a great soloist prepares us to play a certain way, but then with the added inspiration of an audience, a certain extra dimension comes in, and we're prepared and we can go there with it.
So you really have to be on and aware. You can't just
yes.
be playing the notes.
Well, you are playing the notes, but you're also creating something in that moment which only happens in that moment. There is something about live performance that, however great recordings are, can never ever be reproduced in recording, because
right.
everyone sitting there in that audience knows that something is happening that can only happen live in that theater with that audience and that soloist and that orchestra and that conductor one time.
There's analogies, of course, in forms like ballet. There are some very famous ballet performers who could never really shine in rehearsal, and then once they got on stage, they became the stars that they were.
Yes. Amazing. It's amazing. And great performers are like that, too. The rehearsal will be fine, but the performance will be extraordinary.
Now, Dvorak's New World Symphony is the other piece on the New Year's Eve program, and that is such an interesting piece that I want to go into that a little bit, because part of the inspiration for playing it now is the 403rd anniversary of Santa Fe.
Yes, I think that Dvorak was so visionary. He, of course, was a great composer, and he loved Czech music and his own Czech heritage. However, when he came to the United States in his 40s, he suddenly felt like he was being made aware of a whole new world, and he called the Ninth Symphony that we're going to perform From the New World to pay homage to this country of ours where so many different races and cultures and traditions came together. Dvorak knew, of course, that there were problems and challenges, but he also had this vision that all of the races coming together could create something extraordinary that none of them on their own would be capable of creating. And so he used music from Europe, but he also used Native American music, he used African American music, and he blended it all in this synthesis, which is From the New World. You talked about the success of Beethoven's Seventh at its premiere. Well, this work at its premiere was so successful that every single movement had to be encored. It was an extraordinary triumph.
You mean, how does that work? So the encore happens, and then after the first movement, they say, play it again.
Yeah, the audience doesn't stop screaming until they play it again. So they
can't even go on to the next movement until they play the first one again.
Yeah, it must have been a long concert. I wish I had been there.
Wow. And that was in 1893.
Yes, it was.
So let's hear, maybe we can play one or two bits of this that have that reference to Native American music and then Black American spirituals.
Yes.
Here's a section from the first movement. And here's a section from Dvorak's New World Symphony, second movement, inspired by Black American spirituals. And that is from Dvorak's New World Symphony. And once again, the Dvorak and Rachmaninoff Piano Concerto will be played on New Year's Eve at 5 o'clock at the Lenzik. Joe Illick is Artistic and Executive Director of the Santa Fe Concert Association, which can be found on the web at santafeconcerts.org. You can also call 505-984-8759. And then the Lenzik number is
988-1234.
Lots of numbers. Joe Illick, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
And we'll see you tomorrow morning when we're talking about Christmas music through the ages.
Wonderful.
And we're going to take a little break right now. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned. I'd like now to welcome Annie Rafter. She is a nurse practitioner with a specialty in women's health, and we are here to talk about winter colds, viruses, diseases, and all the things that happen around the holiday season. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So how much, first of all, are you seeing H1N1 in your practice?
Well, it's hard to tell because the CDC has asked us not to really follow up whether it's H1N1 unless the person gets really sick and is hospitalized. So in the beginning with H1N1, we were testing everybody to see if they had influenza A, because H1N1 is an influenza A, so we could screen for it that way. And they were so overwhelmed by testing that they said, whoa, stop. We're just going to... I mean, for the majority of people, H1N1 is not a big deal. I mean, they get sick, they feel bad, their bodies deal with it. For people who have other kinds of illnesses, like lung disease, asthma, things like that, it's riskier. For the very young and the older people who have, you know, health issues, other health issues, it's more of a risk.
And I thought older people were less of a risk on this particular virus because they had immunity to it because some of a virus that had gone around years ago.
Yes, that is true. And it's also true that what happens with H1N1 is not the virus that causes all the problems. It's the body's immune response to it. So people in their 40s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 40s and 50s and 60s, if they're healthy, are less at risk for both those reasons. One, they may have been exposed to it in 68 when there was an outbreak. And they may have, their immune system may not be so fired up, and so they don't get the same kind of intense immune response that younger people get. So it's really younger people in your 20s, teens and 20s, who are the most at risk for H1N1.
So their immune system is working faster than ours, let's say.
Right.
And therefore...
Right. They have a stronger immune reaction, causes the problems.
So what are some of the actual problems that you're seeing in those groups?
Mostly it's lung. Mostly it's associated with the ability to breathe. And there are some other side effects, but mostly the real illness is that there you get so much influx of white blood cells and mast cells to the lung that they essentially suffocate.
Good heavens.
On it, which is what makes it so dangerous.
Have you been seeing patients who are in that position?
No. Not in my practice. I've not seen anybody yet. I'm knocking on wood.
Knocking on wood here in the baking
I've had
company.
Some people who are pretty sick, and we figured out it probably was H1N1, but we've managed to, you know, get them through that without their being, you know, hospitalized or that really sick. And the key thing with H1N1 is to recognize that if you're feeling sick, if you get the flu and it's acting like a regular flu, even though you have some chest congestion, you just treat it the way you would treat a regular flu, but you pay attention. And, you know, if you're somebody who has asthma or has some lung disease or you have other illnesses like diabetes that is not well controlled or, you know, any really kind of chronic medical illness, then you probably ought to get to your doctor right away. But otherwise, treat it like the flu, act like it's the flu. As long as you can breathe, you're doing okay. If you start having trouble breathing, if you feel short of breath or your fingernails start turning blue or you know you're not thinking quite clearly, and again, that's having other people around you who notice that kind of thing, then just go to the emergency room.
Fingernails turning blue is a respiratory symptom?
Yeah, you're not getting enough oxygen in your blood system, and so your fingernails turn blue when you don't have enough oxygen in your blood.
So people wearing opaque nail polish, you can rub that right off. So H1N1, I mean, I have to say, I and a number of people I know had bouts of that right really before the flu season started, mm-hmm. and it was very easy. Mm-hmm. It was easier than the common cold because mm-hmm. the main symptom was great fatigue. You go to bed, a few days later it's gone.
Mm-hmm. And as long as you're healthy and that's your response, that's great. And that's what it's turning out to be the response for the vast majority of us. The people for whom it's not the response and they do get lung things, it can be life-threatening.
Now, you in your practice also have to just deal with the variety of ailments that happen when the weather is cold. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it's exacerbated at holiday times because of stress, because mm-hmm. of people traveling, people being in airplanes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, stress is a major issue. When you're particularly stressed, one of the first things that happens is your immune system is compromised. So you're more likely to pick things up. And what stress actually is it's a biochemical change in your body that's built in as a fight or flight reaction for our ability to get out of a life-threatening situation. And but we're meant to go through those. We were designed originally by nature to go through those episodes and then be able to sit around the fire and talk to each other about it and go, wow, I couldn't believe what happened, and get over it, you know, and process that out, and then our biochemistry goes back to normal. But we're under the kind of stress, I like to call it the stress of affluence. You know, some of us are worried about where we're going to get our next meal, especially with this economic situation. But most of us have a place to live and enough food to eat, that kind of thing. But we're stressed by trying to do too much. You know, it's like we have all of this stuff available to us, and we're trying, we think that because it's available, we should be able to access it all and do it all. And so we don't really have the downtime to reshift that internal biochemistry. And of course, Christmas, it's like, I mean, the holidays, it's not just Christmas for us, it's the holidays is do, you know, and traveling and getting all the presents and doing all, you know, the cards and whatever that people do. It's like it amps it up. And I believe that what goes on in a community of people happens, you know, affects everybody. So I noticed that, you know, I'm not traveling this Christmas and I'm feeling kind of calm about it and, you know, easy. And I'm feeling this amp around me. I'm aware of the sort of the energies amped up this time of year. And so it's kind of stressful. And that affects our immune system. The other thing I was talking to somebody about today is that increased intake of sugar affects our internal biochemistry as well. And of course, that's something that happens over the holidays is we're all eating much more sugar than we would normally be eating. Cookies, candy, that kind of thing, presents people give or sweets. And it's what we do. But that also increases the stress, the biochemical stress in our system. And some people tolerate it fine, and other people don't. And so it's, you know, knowing, it's recognizing in yourself, watching your patterns, but just keeping aware that if you tend to get sick over the holidays, it may very well be the added stress of all the sugar.
There is also, I don't know if you can speak to this, but there is a stress, I think, associated with media, like having a TV on a lot, things right. like that. That
enters your system. Stress, yeah. And years ago, I was looking for the centralizing construct for Western medicine. You know, Ayurvedic has Pitta, Vata, Kapha. Acupuncture has the meridian system. And Western medicine really more is a decentralizing construct. It's like take it apart, see what works. But I think that's, I see that as being dangerous for people because if I give you an antibiotic, for instance, I have to know how that's going to affect your whole system. If I'm being conscientious with you and we're going to maintain your health. So I was looking for that, and what I came up with the help of some other people was that the construct of assimilation. So how do we take things, first of all, how do we know we need something for our body? Then how do we take that in? How do we break it down to its component parts, take what we need for our well-being, and get rid of what we don't need? And the media, that's a huge issue because we're getting information all the time, and we don't really have the time to break that down. What does that all mean?
Right.
And there have been plenty of studies done that people who consistently watch the news have an impaired immune system because it's a stressor.
That is so interesting.
It's a huge stressor. If you don't know how to deal with right. the information you're getting, what do you do with that?
Well, there's also, I mean, one of the, something I was reading was saying that a great stressor is not having control in your life. So somebody working on an assembly line or in a job where they've got one or more bosses is actually more stressed out than the CEO of the company who, although they have a great deal more responsibility, has less stress because they have control over their own time and over the decisions that are made.
Yeah, I saw that program, and I think it's true that if you have the sense, if you have the what can be illusion, that you have control over your life, then there's less stress in that aspect of your life.
But then if you're looking at the programs about health care reform or all these things that you really don't have control over, no matter how
hard
you try.
I think control is an illusion. And I think that every spiritual program there ever was says it's letting go of the delusion that you have to be in control of your life. But that's a whole other conversation.
Very interesting. We're talking to nurse practitioner Annie Rafter. So you do allopathic medicine. You're a nurse practitioner trained in allopathic medicine here in Santa Fe. A lot of people use and demand herbal medicine and other traditions, as
right.
you've
really
just mentioned.
What my practice is functional medicine. So it's a combination of allopathic, where I think that's necessary, and I use a lot of herbs, and I use a lot of alternative things in my practice as well. So it's looking at how our bodies function. It's like one of the treatments I have for flu is a vitamin, an IV vitamin, combined vitamin and mineral IV, that seems to be very effective against viral infections. And so it's not a prescription. I try really hard. I write a lot of prescriptions, but I try really hard not to. I try really hard to do it with what we call nutraceuticals, that are natural products instead.
How can you, as a nurse practitioner, and we as people trying to stay healthy, make sense of the whole world of herbal medicine? For example, there was a study that showed that echinacea really doesn't do anything, and then people swear by echinacea, and there's a lot of things like that. The studies haven't been done, or maybe they have sometimes, or maybe the studies come to a conclusion that doesn't match with what your patients say.
Well, I mean, one of the problems with evidence-based medicine, and I'm not saying here that I object to evidence-based medicine, because I think it's really, really helpful to look at what are we doing. I mean, I think it's one of the best things that Western medicine does, is we look at what we're doing to see if it really works. But the problem with it, if you're looking at it from a quantum physics standpoint, is that what the tester expects is often what they get. And so if you have somebody doing the research who thinks that herbs are bunk, then you're likely to get a result that herbs are bunk. The problem with herbal medicine is that it doesn't make the kind of money, although it does make a fair amount of money, it doesn't make the kind of money that pharmaceutical medicine is making. And so there isn't the money there, or the desire, really, to study these things, because they're not patentable. So it's word of mouth. It's like, this helped me, so you try, you know, let me try this. And in some ways, it really is, when you're approaching keeping yourself healthy during the wintertime, it's really kind of word of mouth. Echinacea works great for some people. It doesn't work well for other people. I like astragalus root, because astragalus root is a adaptogenic. And you can push your immune system too hard, and that's what the autoimmune diseases are. They are an overactive immune system.
Like allergies.
Allergies, lupus, MS. There are a lot of lichen sclerosis, ectropicus. They're just, you know, hundreds of these autoimmune diseases that are really from an overactive immune system that's attacking itself because of changes. We think that what's happening is that there are changes in the chromosome. The chromosome is damaged by toxins in our bodies. And then the body doesn't perceive that chromosome as itself anymore, and so it attacks it. But it often happens to people who have a very active immune system. So
what chromosome are you talking about? I mean, every cell has a chromosome.
It can be any of the whole line of chromosomes.
But I mean, when you say there are changes in your chromosomes of one whole organ,
it's called a SNP, and it's damage to a particular chromosome that tells it one part of your body to do a specific thing.
But I mean, a chromosome is one of many chromosomes in a cell.
Chromosomes are basically the book of your DNA, and when your body is triggered to do a certain thing, it's picking what page out of that book is going to be read.
Right, but every single cell in your body has the same book.
Right.
And so when one of them gets damaged in one cell,
it affects the whole body.
More on that another time.
That's a whole other conversation.
Yeah. What do you recommend for people to stay healthy so that they don't even have to go into the doctor during the winter?
A couple of things. I think it's really wise to use some sort of nutraceutical, some sort of herbal approach. If you're traveling, if you know you're particularly stressed, things like I'm moving, somebody in my family has died, good stress like I'm getting married, these kinds of things can decrease your immune system. And often in times like this, you're around crowds of people, and the more people you're around, the more likely you are to be exposed to a virus or a bacterial infection. So things like echinacea or astragalus root, or I mean, there are hundreds of them out there to take before you travel. I particularly like a substance called Wellness Formula that's made by Source Natural. It's a combination of garlic and other herbs, and it's just this fortuitous combination of herbs they've come up with. It works really well. And it's great to take if your symptoms begin. It's not so effective, I don't think, as a long-term thing. The body gets used to it. But if you're traveling or if you're really stressed and you know you're going to be around a lot of people, it's a great thing to take like 3 tablets of that 3 times a day just while you're traveling. And often it'll prevent you from getting sick. Also, there are any number of Chinese herbals that are particularly good for prevention of these kinds of things that you can take at the first sign of the slightest, you know, you start getting that kind of scratchy feeling in your throat. If you do it then, often they work. Liquid iodine, you know, we think of iodine as being poisonous.
You put it on your cuts.
Yeah, you put it on your cuts. But you can get liquid iodine now that's called Lugol's solution at the health food stores. And a couple of drops of that in a glass of water on your throat when you're traveling will prevent you from picking things up. So there's a lot of preventative things that can help. And, you know, if you don't know specifically what they are, most of the health food stores have a list of them, and you can talk with people there. Pharmaca is really good about that. They have practitioners there, and they can help.
What if you actually start coming down with something?
There are a number of approaches to that. There's a homeopathic called Oscicillium that if you take it as soon as you begin to get symptoms, it can help people. Some people it works great for. Any of these things, some people it works great for, some people it doesn't. So you have to kind of hunt and
can
shop.
Can you tell by examining somebody who is going to be a better candidate for this or that remedy?
No, unfortunately.
You just have
not.
To spend your money.
Yeah,
and
it's kind of trial and error so far. I wish I could. That would be great. Then if you really start coming down with it, you can do something like Wellness Formula. And Wellness Formula, when you're feeling sick, is 3 tablets every 3 hours. So it's really a lot. You got to be able to tolerate garlic to do that. And then if you get sick, we have an intravenous called Myers Formula that we give, and there are a couple of other people in town who are doing it as well. And it's an IV of calcium, magnesium, vitamin C, B5, B6, B12, and B complex.
Now, all those things are in the supplements that a lot of people take
right.
every morning.
Right.
What's so good about getting it intravenously?
Because if you take it every morning, you don't get the dosage that you get when it's intravenous. It's just your body doesn't let it get that high in your bloodstream.
So it has a natural filtering mechanism.
It has a natural filtering mechanism and won't let you get those kinds of levels in what we call a bolus, all at once in
right.
the bloodstream. And by doing this intravenous, and it's a push, it's not a drip, and it goes in, you know, depending on your response to it. And when you're taking it, you get a kind of a hot flash in the area where the infection is. For flu, it will pretty much stop it in its tracks if you get it in the first 24 to 48 hours of having the flu. Colds, it takes 2 of them to really shorten the cold and get you over it. But people are coming to me after being sick for 6 weeks, and with the Myers formula, it doesn't last more than a week.
Very interesting. Annie Rafter is a nurse practitioner specializing in women's health. We're talking about Christmas holiday, winter-related health issues. And if people want to contact you, how should they do that?
My phone number is 984-8262. My receptionist is named Joe. I do limit my practice to women, but for flu and things like that, I'm also treating men for that. We're not being restrictive.
And children as well.
And children. Well, I haven't done it a lot in little children. I think anybody 10 years old or older. Younger than that, kids respond differently, and also small children don't like IVs. So
yeah, so they should go to pediatricians.
Yeah, they need to see their pediatrician.
Anything else that you want to let people know about?
Well, I think probably, and this may sound easy to say and hard to do, but I think that when we have the idea of how our lives ought to be, and it's something that we don't have that we want, We want our parents to behave a certain way. We want our sisters and brothers to behave a certain way around the holidays. We want certain gifts. We, you know, our well-being has to do with what somebody else does. That's the major stressor for the holidays. And if we can practice, and I think it really is sort of a spiritual practice, to let that go, you know, to look at what we have been given and what is working, the good things about our parents and our brothers and sisters and our family, that lowers the stress level. And it really makes it possible to get through the holidays in a completely different way and a much healthier way.
Practicing gratitude.
Practicing gratitude. Exactly. And watching what you eat and how much you drink and all of that stuff is biochemistry. It all affects our bodies biochemically. And when our bodies are affected biochemically, then that changes our immune system and our ability to fight off these things.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you very much for being here and wish you very happy holidays, Christmas, New Year.
You too.
Thank you so
Thanks.
Much.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe, and we're going to go out with just a little piece of Dvorak's New World Symphony.